Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Our program is taking tomorrow off, but we will be back on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You know we have a weekend edition of the program that airs as well. Emmanuel Berry is your host every Saturday and Sunday. Coming up later this hour, it's Neighbors in Action Wednesday. We learn about just all kinds of great work being done at Advent House Ministries. They are involved in a variety of different activities, helping people in the community. We'll learn about that. We'll explore why millions of American children do not get adequate dental care, even children covered by Medicaid, from Shelley Geshen, who is director of the Pew Children's Dental Campaign. There's a new study that they've come out with, which is rather sobering, and we continue looking back on the sesquicentennial of the U.S. Civil War and Michigan's role in that. All coming up on Current State. We hope you can stay close. At the top of the program, developments in the world of genetics, which are sometimes very difficult to understand, can still be mesmerizing. A newspaper headline from last Friday is a case in point. It read, UK may okay creating babies with DNA from three people. We had to learn more. Joining us to explain the process, which has been dubbed three-parent embryos, is Michigan State University genetics professor Dr. Helga Torriello. Dr. Torriello also works in the Pediatrics and Human Development Department at Spectrum Health in Grand Rapids. Helga Torriello, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I am well, and we're glad to have you on the program here today. What exactly triggers the need for DNA from three people instead of just from two?
The basic reason this process is done is to avoid the transmission of mutations in mitochondrial DNA from mother to child.
So this is an opportunity to avoid some pretty serious disorders?
Oh, absolutely. Most of these disorders are associated with neurologic dysfunction, muscle weakness, sometimes referred to as muscular dystrophy, diabetes, hearing loss, vision loss, dementia, and so on.
Mm-hmm. As simply as you can here for us, Helga, please describe the mechanics of what happens.
You know, I've been trying to figure out a way of conveying the concept of mitochondrial genome.
You're taking us all back to our 11th grade biology here this morning.
Seriously. but basically, we humans have two sets of genes. The vast majority of genes are in the nucleus, kind of like the egg yolk. If you were to envision a cell as looking like an egg, the nucleus is the egg yolk, and mm-hmm. 20,000 genes are in this egg yolk.
Okay.
But the egg white contains mitochondria, which are the so-called powerhouses of the cell. They're the energy producers and drive organ function and so on. But anyway, there are thousands of mitochondria in the egg white or the cytoplasm, and each mitochondrion contains its own set of genes. Now, each mitochondrion has 37 genes. Now, you compare that to the 20,000 in the nucleus, so you can see that these are just a drop in the bucket genetically. But when one of these genes in the mitochondria is altered, it can affect function of all of the organ systems that I just mentioned, because there are, as I mentioned, thousands of mitochondria in the cytoplasm. And each mitochondria has a mutated gene, there's basically a huge effect on the function of that organism. Anyone that's familiar with genetics knows that if there's a change in just a single gene in one of the nuclear genes, it can be a devastating effect. And most people are familiar with things like Huntington's disease, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis, and so on.
And the DNA from the third person, though, that replaces what? That replaces faulty mitochondria?
Yes.
Okay.
And so we would take the nucleus from the biologic mother's egg cell, and then the sperm has no cytoplasm, so we only get nuclear DNA from dad. And the donor would contribute the cytoplasm or the mitochondrial genes. And so you're basically taking the egg yolk from mom and sticking it into a yolkless white egg.
Okay.
From the donor. That's a really bad analogy, I know, but hopefully the listeners can envision what I'm talking about.
If you can, help us understand one particular part of this story, and this came from the Associated Press's Maria Chang. On one hand, the story claims that about 1 in 200 children born in Britain have one of these mitochondrial disorders. Later in the story, it's claimed that if this process is approved, and this is probably years down the road before this becomes reality. We have to make that clear to our listeners. Mm-hmm. But if it's approved, the procedure would likely be used only in about a dozen women a year. That seems like quite a discrepancy. Do you know what that means? Does that mean that mitochondrial disorders are generally not serious?
Where I believe the discrepancy arises is from the fact that when we refer to mitochondrial disorders, we're talking about conditions that can be caused by changes or mutations in mitochondrial DNA as well as nuclear genes.
Okay.
And the vast majority of mitochondrial disorders are caused by mutations in nuclear genes or the genes in the egg yolk, going back to my old analogy.
Okay.
Only about 5%, if that, of mitochondrial disorders are caused by mitochondrial mutations or mutations in the mitochondria. And so one in 200 is probably the highest figure I've seen. Most of the figures I've seen are between 1 in 1,000 and 1 in 5,000 for the frequency of mitochondrial disorders. And so take 1/20th of those, that ends up being something like 1 in 100,000 to 1 in... Yeah, I can't do the math that fast in my head this morning,
okay.
but it ends up being a very few
situations
where this technique could be a benefit. Many mitochondrial disorders many mitochondrial mutations are new events, and so the parent hasn't even transmitted it to the child.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of appears suddenly.
You spent many years at Spectrum Health actually working with patients with regard to genetic testing, and you've watched a lot of this unfold here, this incredible science unfold. And no doubt you've witnessed new techniques that have been discovered that seem to demonstrate all kinds of promise. But then they don't necessarily play out. There have been some unintended consequences. Can you talk to us about that?
There have been, and I'm a little bit fuzzy on the details now, but there have been cases of gene therapy holding out great promise and just never panning out. And there was one individual, I think Jesse Geisinger, died actually from a gene therapy experiment. And so I believe those trials have since been stopped. There have been cases of, just even simple cases of doing research looking at pedigrees or family histories where, some information was discovered from the pedigree that could have an impact on the individual's health and reproductive planning. And then the issue came up, do we tell them what we found or do we not? And then, of course, with genetic testing, there's been a lot of situations which have kind of challenged us ethically. For example, most recently, laboratories have developed techniques which can sequence all of the genes at once. And so we may see a child that has a number of different problems. The child may have hearing loss, intellectual disability, some structural differences such as a heart defect, cleft palate, and so on. And the clinician decides, okay, let's just do whole genome sequencing and see if we can find the causative gene. Well, we do the testing, or the clinician orders the testing, and the laboratory identifies a mutation in a gene which accounts for all of the things that we see in the child, but then incidentally finds that there's a change in the gene that leads to early onset Alzheimer disease.
Mm.
Early onset Alzheimer has onset as early as the 30s or 40s.
So an incidental discovery.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so then the issue becomes, what do we do with this?
Yeah. How do you feel about the future of genetic testing in general? Do you feel the world, for lack of a better word, does the world have the ethical and scientific grounding to make good, responsible decisions? Are you more of an optimist or are you concerned?
I think the technology, this does not reflect the opinion of Michigan State University or Spectrum. It's simply me, but the technology is exciting. But I think it's sometimes like going into a dark tunnel. We really don't know what we're going to find on the other end. We think we do, but then we get these surprises. And here again, I'm fuzzy on the memory, but remember when they cloned Dolly the sheep?
Yeah.
They didn't realize that when they took an adult cell, that cell would lead to an individual that aged more rapidly because the ends of the chromosomes were shorter. Chromosome shortening is one of the reasons thought to lead to normal aging. I mean, put another way, as an individual normally ages, their chromosomes get shorter.
Okay.
So this little cloned offspring had shortened telomeres. Like, oh, didn't know that happened, so...
I have to ask you about one other development. 3 weeks ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that companies cannot patent genes that occur in nature. How do you feel about that ruling?
I thought it was great. It was wonderful that the Supreme Court ruled that way. This opens the door for other laboratories to offer testing. And what we have found is that Medicaid, as strapped as they are, really is good at paying for testing, but it's better at paying for testing in-state than out-of-state. And when there's only one laboratory offering testing, and that lab is out of state, the families are put in a bind because they can't afford to pay out of pocket for this genetic testing, which is often very expensive.
Understood.
Several thousand dollars, for example. But then if the University of Michigan or Michigan State or Spectrum develops the test for breast cancer testing or any other testing which has been limited to one laboratory because of patent issues, it opens the door, so to speak, for these families to get testing covered by, that is covered, get testing even if they have Medicaid or Medicare coverage.
Understood. We have been talking about three-parent embryos and all kinds of related topics. It is a fascinating area, and our guest has been Michigan State University genetics professor Dr. Helga Torriello, who also works in the Pediatrics and Human Development Department at Spectrum Health in Grand Rapids. Thanks for your time, Dr. Torriello.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR, and it's Wednesday, which means it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment. We feature people and organizations working to make the Lansing area a better place. This week we feature Lansing's Advent House Ministries. The agency offers comprehensive services from job readiness training to transitional shelter to literacy programs on Lansing's west side. Here to tell us more about Advent House Ministries is Executive Director Susan Cancro. Hi, Susan.
Hello.
And joining her is Tim Sears. Tim is a veteran and a participant in their Healthy Life Skills for Employment program. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Susan, tell us about what you do at Advent House Ministries. It's a lot, I know.
I'll try to summarize.
Maybe the better question is what you don't do there.
Yes, I thought you might go there.
You're involved in a lot.
We are. We've been around for 26 years, and in that time we have reached out to those who are most in need in the community, focusing on homelessness as an issue. And we've helped individuals and families, hundreds and thousands of people over the years. We offer everything from food on weekends. We're the only weekend day shelter in Lansing. We're open all day, every Saturday, every Sunday, offering meals that are prepared by local groups, mostly churches and religious groups, but some community groups. We served over 34,000 meals last year to over 2,000 people. And we also, from that program, that was our core program, we discovered the need for employment assistance and literacy assistance. So we've developed employment programs and literacy programs and, of course, housing programs when people are homeless.
Tim Sears, you're a veteran. Tell us a little bit about your background. And I understand you were formerly homeless and looking for work. What got you to this this place in your life?
I was working in the construction field for a few years, and with the downturn in the economy, that kind of hurt the job situation. So I decided I was going to go back to school, and I moved in with some family members while I was going to school. But the between work and school, I wasn't able to contribute as much as was necessary for me to stay there. So at the time, I needed to find some place to live, and I just happened to be riding on the bus and talked to a gentleman, and he told me about the Veterans Housing Program in Lansing, and from there, I was able to connect with the Advent House, and they really helped me as far as working on my resume, putting me in contact with different groups that were looking to hire veterans. And I'm actually in the process of interviewing with one of the local companies here in Lansing.
When were you most challenged? When did you feel you were really struggling the most?
Probably the first couple weeks when I wasn't sure what I was going to do. Pretty difficult to not know where you're going to sleep from night to night, where you're going to get your next meal, what your future holds. It's having that support group around you, groups like Advent House, really helps give you a feeling of stabilized living, and you feel like there's something, a future ahead for you. And those first couple weeks were probably the most difficult until I was able to get into the Veterans Housing Program and connect with Advent House and a couple other groups and really feel like there was some light at the end of the tunnel.
The state, the Snyder administration in particular, has been pushing Michigan employers to reach out to strengthen their connection with veterans in particular. Have you noticed any impact of that? Is that actually playing out in your experience?
As much as I'd like to think so, I haven't personally seen that, but as I was speaking with Susan earlier today, the thing that I've noticed the most is the competition out there. There's 100 to 125 people for every job application. One particular job I went through three interviews with, and it came down to somebody having three more months worth of experience. So the difficulty in that, but as far as the veterans concerned, I think a lot of that is businesses don't realize that you can get anywhere between $2,500 and $10,000 tax incentive if you hire a veteran right now. And that's from the federal level. And I don't think a lot of businesses realize that. That can be some significant money, especially for smaller companies looking to hire good, strong workers. Look for veterans because there's some tax incentive involved in that as
well. Quite an incentive. Susan, where does your funding come from?
Well, it comes from government, some of it, from the private sector. We have grants.
State or federal?
We have federal grants. We have from HUD. That's how we fund the program. The Good Work Employment Program is funded by HUD to help people who've been homeless to get jobs. And I have to say quickly on that side, HUD expects 10% of people who are homeless to be employed. We have 65% of our folks getting employed. You know, in this economy, that's incredible.
Yeah.
These are a lot of entry-level jobs for people, not everybody, but a lot. And people want to work. I think it's a real testimony to the people in the program. I mean, we have a good tool. We have an excellent tool that we offer. I have great staff. But people have to want to do this, and they do. They are the ones that make that work. So we have money from the federal government. We have some state money. We have county money, city money. The city of Lansing is very supportive. Ingham County is very supportive. And we also have private foundation grants. We have the Dollar General grant for our literacy program. We do pay for GED testing, which is a huge expense for people with nothing who really want to just get ahead with a simple diploma or certificate. So that's a wonderful gift to us.
And I assume you weren't involved in GED testing 25 years ago. Your focus 25 years ago was homelessness.
That's right.
But it has, over the years, evolved into all kinds of different areas.
We were started by what is now North Westminster Presbyterian Church. We're still in that building. They are extremely supportive of us. They simply wanted to reach out to the community and feed people on Saturday. This all started with a meal. And now here we are,
wow,
all these years later, with wonderful programs and very good community support. Although we always, you know, money is always tight. And sequestration, of course, is affecting a lot of those government grants, which are big chunks of money in our budget.
Has that impacted you noticeably?
Yes.
The sequestration specifically, I mean.
Well, yes. Every grant we have, as reductions come from the federal government or anyone, it goes back to sequestration, which is just another symptom of just trying to spend down or reduce spending across the board, whether it's up at the top of government or right down here at the very base of society where we're, you know, working on the ground level with people. Mm-hmm. So it affects everybody.
Current State's Neighbors in Action segment is exploring the work of Advent House Ministries here in Lansing with Susan Cancro and Tim Sears. Tim, what's next for you?
Next for me, hopefully, is I get this job that I just have recently had a couple interviews for. And then when that's...
Construction?
Actually in recruiting for a local company, recruiting employees. I'm going to school currently for human resource management, so this is kind of, I'm transitioning from the labor aspect into the administrative aspect for myself. And hopefully I get that, and then shortly thereafter I can get my own place and just, you know, become have a more stable lifestyle again.
Do you have a family?
I don't. I'm just myself. I'm single.
Okay. What is it that most people don't understand about being homeless? Is there something you've learned that just isn't out there in people's awareness?
Yeah, I personally, I probably had the same viewpoint that a lot of people had when I saw somebody that was homeless. I thought, you know, somebody that was asking for money, they're just trying to get their next drink or trying to get their next drug. Having personally experienced this, I can tell you, yeah, of course there are some people out there that are like that, but majority of people, you know, where I'm staying currently, we've had lawyers, very educated people that just one thing or another happened to them. They lost their job, lost their home. There are a lot of homeless people out there that are doing everything that they possibly can to get their life back. And it's just remember that just because somebody's homeless doesn't mean that they're a lower member of society. There's a lot of people out there that are homeless that are really working hard to try to get their life back. And one thing or another has happened and put them in that situation, and they're just trying to get out of it. So I think that would be the biggest thing that I've learned is that it's not everybody out there that's homeless isn't just trying to drink their life away or trying to drug their life away.
I think the Great Recession changed an awful lot of that. I think an awful lot of people were impacted by this whopping recession we suffered starting 4 years ago that really changed the landscape.
Well, did you want me to contribute?
Yeah, please do.
I am currently the chair of the Greater Lansing Homeless Resolution Network, and that's a network of all of the agencies in the area that work on the issue of homelessness. Over the last couple of years, what we saw coming from the government was money and a mandate to work with a much broader section of the population, where we had been working with people who were more at risk in many ways, not able to function too well because of education, you know, deficits or that kind of thing. Suddenly, we had a broad swath of the population coming in, newly homeless, mm-hmm, and needing help. And that's a very different situation, very different set of skills that need to be out there. But we're good at what we do, all of us, our agencies. And we were able to address those issues and help people get back on their feet quickly because they had the skills. They just needed a break. They needed somebody to open a door so they could step through and start again.
So you feel your mission at Advent House changed noticeably just in the past 4 years on that account?
Well, yes. Our mission has always been to help the most at risk. And we've been very careful it's easy to pull away from that and start to help people who are more able when there are other agencies to help. But when the population in need grows to that extent, we have to take our part. And we know our part is to assist not only those more in need in terms of more deficits maybe in training, but those more in need of overall support. We have a very good, I think, way of coming to people and creating a strong sense of trust, no sense of shame. We're all on the same level. Let's get to work, take care of business, and let's go forward, whatever the problem is. That's how we approach things. And I think in the network of agencies, I'm sure that in many ways that's true of everyone, but we all work together. Mm-hmm. And so we could not do what we do without the help of these other agencies. We work very closely with Volunteers of America, with the National Council on Alcoholism, with EVES, which is the Ending Violent Encounters, the Domestic Violence Shelter, and other Loaves and Fishes. I mean, I could name them all.
Sure.
My peers here doing this work. Yeah. I've been there for 19 years at Advent House, and I've seen some terrific people do some amazing work, and I've met some amazing people.
Tell us how people access your services, and if you're assuming you're always looking for volunteers, how do they reach you?
Okay, people can access our services by calling us at 485-4722. That's our phone number, 517-485-4722. We are also online. Our website is www.adventhouse.com, not org, com, adventhouse.com. And we have information on the website about our programs for people who want to access services or people who would like to volunteer. And if they would like to support us, they can also donate through the website or call us or send us donations. We always are accepting help, and we know the community is out there for us. We've been very blessed.
Susan Cancro is the executive director of the Advent House Ministries. Tim Sears is a veteran. We commend you for your service, by the way, sir, and a participant in Advent House's Healthy Life Skills for Employment program. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Current State could use your help. We are always looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action segment. We know there are great people and organizations out there doing great work. And if you'd like one to be featured in our Neighbors in Action segment, send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. Current State on WKAR, we're glad you're here today. According to the Pew Charitable Trusts, national health standards call for children to visit a dentist every 6 months. That recommendation clashes with new data showing that more than 14 million children enrolled in Medicaid did not receive any dental care in 2011. Health analysts attribute the problem to a number of factors, including a shortage of dentists. Here to discuss this study and what it means is Shelley Geshen, director of the Pew Children's Dental Campaign. Welcome to Current State, Shelley.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. First of all, give us a brief overview of this study. What did it seek to learn?
The Pew report, which is called In Search of Dental Care, looked at the percentage of kids that are enrolled in Medicaid who received a dental service in 2011. We also looked at the availability of dentists to treat them. So we have state-by-state data, and Michigan is one of the states that's having a serious problem with this.
How did we rank exactly?
Well, Michigan is one of the 10 states where low-income children are least likely to receive dental care. 61.5% of the Medicaid kids, and those are the low-income kids that are most vulnerable and most high risk, did not receive a dental visit in your state.
And why does, and it's not just Michigan, obviously, here, what is creating this disconnect? Why does the United States in general have such trouble providing such a basic service to low-income kids? Shortage of dentists. You alluded to the shortage of dentists on one hand, but what else plays into this?
Well, there are a number of things. Michigan is a state that's actually tried hard to address this problem over the years, but no state has done enough. There are a lot of problems. There's a shortage of dentists overall, and it's getting worse over time. There are impending retirements, a lot of them, as the baby boomer dentists seek to retire. And then there's way too few in every state who accept Medicaid patients. In Michigan, almost 40% of your dentists are over age 55, so in the next 5 to 10 years, they're going to retire, and there aren't enough new ones to take their place. So over time, the shortages are going to get worse, not better.
We're talking with Shelley Geshen. Shelley's the director of the Pew Children's Dental Campaign about the disconnect between low-income kids and proper dental care. One of the challenging features of this is that poor oral health is one thing that can really lead to other poor physical conditions generally. What kinds of conditions do you see in adults who didn't get proper dental care as children?
Well, this report didn't look at that specifically, but basically if you have poor dental health as a kid, you're likely to have poor dental health as a young adult and an adult too. A lot of people who don't have proper access lose teeth. My grandmother was of the generation where a lot of people around her expected to lose their teeth before they die. We don't in my generation. But for poor people, that's still a reality. If you have, and the issue here is that there's such a scarcity of dentists and they're so poorly distributed across states that even people with insurance who know they're supposed to go to a dentist and have been, I think, are going to have trouble getting one in the years to come.
What is this distribution? What's in play there exactly?
Well, every year the federal government collects data. States and localities apply for designation as a shortage area. There's rigorous criteria. It's hard to get designated as a shortage area, so I think the numbers are an undercount. But there are 45 million people across the country who live in federally designated shortage areas, meaning they can't find a dentist. 45 million is a lot. And then you have probably another 40 or 45 million who may technically have dentists nearby, but they can't get to them for one reason or another, or they can't afford them, or they're in an institution, or they're disabled. So our system of care for dental is really fragmented, and it leaves millions of people out.
I'm reminded of these stories that I've heard periodically about bacteria that originate in the mouth that can end up getting into the body and create heart problems. And I mean, you would not associate those two things necessarily.
Well, that's true. Most people don't know that cavities are actually a chronic condition, not an acute condition. Cavities are caused by bacteria, and once they start, they can't, unlike a cold or the flu, you're not going to get better with time and bed rest. You have to get it treated sooner or later. And so, you know, prevention is one of the things we have to do more of, and that's one of the bright spots in Michigan, because 90% of your water is fluoridated. What could be strengthened in Michigan, however, is that there aren't enough sealant programs to put sealants on low-income kids' teeth. Sealants are those clear plastic coatings that go on the back teeth when they come in, and it prevents most of the decay. It's simple, it's cheap, it's effective, but the kids who most need them are least likely to get them. So we need more public health programs to make sure prevention happens in a cost-effective way.
I'm really struck by this this whole generation of baby boomer dentists that are just all of a sudden demographically retiring at roughly the same time. Is there any kind of effort to persuade any of these older dentists to delay their retirement?
I think those are personal decisions. I know the American Dental Association keeps track of this, but I don't think there's an effort to persuade them, no. I think what's happening, though, is that there are more dental schools starting across the country, and there are some dental schools that are increasing their enrollment. But in Michigan, they're also creating a pilot program to train a new type of dental provider called a dental therapist. And that is a mid-level provider similar to a nurse practitioner on the medical side. So that is a proven model from around the world. There are more than 50 other countries that have them, and Alaska and Minnesota have them already, and Michigan will have them too in the next few years. So those are primary care dental providers that would make a world of difference for low-income kids.
How does the Affordable Care Act play into this scenario, if at all?
Well, it's a great question. There's good news and bad news on that score. The good news is that the Affordable Care Act did say that all children should have dental coverage. So if it plays out the way we want it to, millions more children will have dental coverage. The bad news is the system already can't accommodate the ones we've got in there now with insurance. So I think we've got a train wreck up ahead, and that's why we're doing reports like this, because policymakers really need long-term strategies that are sustained over time to address this issue.
Michigan's also been in the headlines recently because we are one of the handful of states that has so far declined to expand to expand Medicaid coverage.
Well, that's a shame for adults. It really is, because they really need the services. But it won't make a difference in demand for dental, because all children will receive coverage. That's not optional under the Affordable Care Act, and dental is supposed to be a required service. So there will be many, many, many new children seeking care, and the system in all across the country is not prepared to treat them. So I hope that policymakers in Michigan will take notice and be proud of what the state has been able to accomplish thus far, because there's a lot of savvy leadership in your state. But it's, you know, the Surgeon General called this a silent epidemic in the year 2000, but it persists as an epidemic, and it isn't so silent anymore.
Shelley Geshen is director of the Pew Children's Dental Campaign. We've been talking about a lack of dental care for poor young children. Shelley Geshen, thanks for joining us on Current State.
It was my pleasure.
The Battle of Gettysburg was fought 150 years ago this week. On the rolling hills of southern Pennsylvania, 90,000 Union troops collided with 75,000 Confederate soldiers. After 3 days, there were nearly 50,000 casualties. It is still the largest battle ever fought in North America. In part three of our commemoration of Gettysburg with MSU historian Roger Rosentrater, Current State Scott Pohl asks him about the battle's influence the battle's influence on the outcome of the Civil War. Rosentrater points out that the epic clash was a major turning point in the war, partly because another significant Union victory occurred just 24 hours later.
At the same time that the Battle of Gettysburg has just happened, the day after, on the 4th of July, the Confederate stronghold on the Mississippi River at Vicksburg is captured by U.S. Grant. So these are two serious blows that the Confederacy take in the early days of July, particularly since only a couple months earlier, things had been going quite well. Matter of fact, Robert E. Lee had enjoyed his greatest battlefield victory 2 months earlier in Virginia at a place called Chancellorsville. So now this becomes a serious setback.
Can you set it up for us regarding what happened in May and June that led
to this ultimate battle?
I can do that. Beginning as early as the spring of 1862 now, the Yankees had been trying a series of campaigns for their On to Richmond effort, which is to capture the Confederate capital. What had happened in those several campaigns is that, long story short, the Yankees lost. And Robert E. Lee, by the spring of 1863 now, has enjoyed a great series of victories, particularly at Fredericksburg and then at Chancellorsville. So it's campaign season, it's the summer, and he decides he's going to raid the North, invade the North for the second time. Now, the first time he had invaded the North was in September of 1862. That resulted in the Battle of Antietam, which is the single bloodiest day of the Civil War, and it also allows Lincoln, despite the fact that it's kind of a Yankee victory, and certainly it allows Lincoln to issue the preliminary emancipation, which is effective the 1st of January, 1863. But Robert E. Lee feels by June of 1863 that there's yet another opportunity. Invading the North might result in a series of goals, one of which would be to, and this sometimes gets overlooked, to take advantage of plundering, basically. Thousands of cattle and other forms of livestock were sent south during as a result of this effort. The fighting had taken place in Virginia for well over a year. He wanted to take the fighting out of Virginia, as it were, which is exactly what he did. At the same time, there's still some hope of diplomatic considerations. Realistically, the British aren't going to intervene, but there's a hope that just maybe a battlefield victory might result in that. There were some evidences of war weariness in the North, and Lee has great contempt for Union generals. And for good reason. He's beaten them all. So at the time that this campaign starts, it culminates in the Battle of Gettysburg, Joe Hooker is the Army commander, Northern Army commander. He's the guy that had lost the Battle of Chancellorsville so dramatically. As a result, Lee says, all right, one more time. I'll try this again. That's what sets up this effort to invade, or sets up the invasion of Pennsylvania.
Geographically, was it coincidental then that this happened at Gettysburg, or was there some other significance to this region that pointed both forces to Gettysburg?
That's actually a very good question. It's coincidental that this battle takes place at Gettysburg. Matter of fact, it's subordinates that kind of bring on the fight. Lee does not want to fight at Gettysburg, never intended to fight at Gettysburg. The new army commander for the Army of the Potomac, which is a northern army, is George Meade. Hooker had gotten angry with Lincoln, had offered his resignation, thinking it wouldn't be accepted, and it was. So literally a week before the Battle of Gettysburg, there's yet another new commander of the northern army, and that's going to be George Meade, who coincidentally is a Pennsylvanian, so there's an advantage there, hopefully, for the northern army. But again, neither officer expected to fight there, neither general expected to fight at Gettysburg. The reason Gettysburg, beyond the fact that subordinates kind of bring the fight on, is there are up to a dozen roads that lead into Gettysburg, which allows you to move troops fairly rapidly. Some of these roads are even paved, which means that even if it were to be wet and muddy, you don't have that issue. So you can move troops quickly to this location.
Tell me now about the role of Michigan in Gettysburg. How big was the presence of fighters from Michigan?
Well, in the Northern Army of about 90,000 men, there are 4,000 Michiganians, and they serve in all branches of the service. There are infantrymen there, there are artillerymen there, there are cavalrymen there, and there, there's some sharpshooters as well. And on each of the 3 days, there will be a Michigan unit that will perform in some form or fashion. I guess I'm hesitant to use the word heroically, that's overused, but maybe the better way to put that, Scott, is to say that on each of the days of the battle, there will be a Michigan unit that will perform significantly in some portion of the fight.
So of these 3 days, are there any particular stories about Michigan's involvement?
One of the better told stories of the early part of the battle is the 24th Michigan. Now, this is largely a Wayne County regiment. It is part of the Iron Brigade, which has already demonstrated its ability on previous battlefields. They will arrive just in the nick of time when the Confederates are pushing into Gettysburg early on the morning of July 1. During the course of several hours of fighting, the Iron Brigade, along with the 24th Michigan, will slow down the Confederates. They will ultimately be pushed out of the town, as it were, but and suffer 80% casualties at the end of that day. So they go into the fight with about 500 men, which is pretty considerable. By the time the day is all over, there are actually about 26 survivors that are left. Ultimately, a few other stragglers will join on. 80% casualties, which is pretty dramatic. There are few, if any, regiments that would suffer those type of numbers in any battle, actually.
Roger, you've brought to my attention the role of a Michigan woman in the battle at Gettysburg.
One of the more remarkable Michiganians at the Battle of Gettysburg is a woman by the name of Annie Etheridge. Now, there aren't a lot of women serving in the ranks in the Army. Obviously, that wasn't allowed in the 1860s. But Annie Etheridge was in her early 20s. She stood 5'3", and she actually went off to war in the summer of 1861, and she becomes the equivalent of a modern combat medic. Matter of fact, one contemporary observed that she had a vigorous constitution and was decidedly good-looking. And I could spend a lot of time giving you a lot of details, but what she would find herself doing, again, not serving, you know, with a musket or in the ranks, and she didn't have an enlistment papers or anything like that, but she was there helping the wounded. There are plenty of stories of where she played an important role in assisting not only the wounded, but sometimes even inspiring men to stand up and fight, as it were. Matter of fact, let me give you one last story about her, because not only was she at Gettysburg, a year later, in the spring of 1864, Grant now is in the East. He's really commanding the Union armies. And he decided that people like Annie Etheridge needed to be removed from the front lines. Well, he's in charge, and he could order that being done. What was unique about this situation is that Annie's role among her regiment, 5th Michigan, as it were, was that it led to a petition being circulated. Now, it just wasn't privates and sergeants who signed it. Junior officers signed it, and brigade, division, and corps commanders signed it too, saying, Annie needs to stay with us. She shouldn't go back to the rear lines. Apparently had an impact. Annie Etheridge served the entire 4 years of the Civil War, only leaving service in the summer of 1865. She is buried in Arlington Cemetery today.
MSU historian Roger Rosentrater, thank you for helping us remember the role of Michigan at Gettysburg.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Current State is adding new contributors in the coming months. Yesterday on the program, you heard our new book reviewer, Scott Southard. Today, we bring you a movie commentary by MSU professor and filmmaker Jeffrey Ray. Disney's The Lone Ranger opens nationwide today. Jeffrey only needed to see the trailer to offer us his thoughts.
The other day I went to the movies. I arrived a bit early to catch the trailers and to make my mental notes. Must see, might see, or wait for that one to come out on DVD. I saw a trailer that surprised me a bit. It was for The Lone Ranger. And of course what threw me most was Johnny Depp playing Tonto. The Lone Ranger is an American classic first heard on radio, then in books, then seen in movie serials. The most famous Lone Ranger is from early television with Clayton Moore as the Lone Ranger and Jay Silverhills as his trusty sidekick Tonto.
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver, the Lone Ranger.
For the new Disney movie, I was hopeful that the trailer would offer evidence for a fresh story and perhaps a reconsidered Tonto. Johnny Depp going native is certainly a different concept, but as soon as he spoke up in character, any hope I had for a new Lone Ranger and a revisionist Tonto was dashed.
If we ride together, we ride for justice.
Justice is what I seek, Kimosabe.
I really hope I am wrong, but from the preview, Depp's Tonto seemed to be the same old sidekick in support of white man's justice. The only difference being in this 2013 version, a white man plays Tonto. Love Johnny Depp. He channeled a great Keith Richards playing a pirate. He is one of the most likable and bankable movie stars in the world. I understand all of that. But I also know that the colored sidekick as subservient stock character shows up in too many American classics. Cato to the Green Hornet. Bill Bojangles Robinson to Shirley Temple. Sam's melancholy piano to Bogart's lovesick Rick. Sammy to Rat Packer's Frank and Dean. Haji to Johnny Quest, and on and on. A mystical feather-headed Johnny Depp in red face, speaking stilted, halting English, feels very retro. And not the cool, hip kind of retro. For the sake of contrast, I look back at 1974's Blazing Saddles.
He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. His job.
With this film, Mel Brooks turned the classic American Western on its head. Blazing Saddles was silly, profane, subversive, and funny. It featured Brooks himself in a minor role as a Yiddish-speaking Indian chief. At its most brave, the film had Cleavon Little as the heroic black sheriff saving a town under siege, and Gene Wilder as his white sidekick, a down-and-out gunslinger.
Hey, maybe you should eat something first.
No, thanks. Food makes me sick.
A man drink like that and he don't eat, he is going to die.
When?
Not your father's John Wayne Western. Blazing Saddles was forward-thinking almost 40 years ago and still is today. I get the feeling that the new Lone Ranger will be no Blazing Saddles. Then again, I could be wrong. But just from the trailer, I will wait for this latest Lone Ranger to show up on DVD before giving my final thumbs up or thumbs down to Kemosabe and Tonto as played by Johnny Depp. This time, maybe he'll channel a little Mick Jagger.
The men you seek think you are dead, Kemosabe. Better to stay that way.
For Current State, this is Jeffrey C. Ray.
And Jeffrey Ray is an MSU professor and filmmaker. Listen for more of Jeffrey's thoughts on film coming up here on Current State. Next week, we should point out, Current State gets out of Studio S. We head to downtown Lansing to broadcast live from the Common Ground Festival. This alters our normal routine in a pretty big way. We ordinarily come to you live between 9 and 10 a.m. and repeat that at noon and 6 p.m. We will be live all next week between 6 and 7 p.m. from Adado Riverfront Park. We'll re-air that at 9 and noon the next day. We'll bring you some of the sounds of the Common Ground Festival. We'll stay on top of everything else that's going on to the best of our ability as well. So we hope you enjoy that. We're looking forward to it a lot. Next week at Common Ground. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Becky McKendry for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great weekend. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.